The government's bid to tackle the housing crisis generates the lead story in three of today's papers after the Affordable Housing Bill was given approval to publish at a cabinet meeting yesterday. The Irish Times leads with the fierce opposition which the bill met in the Dáil, with opposition TDs insisting that it will push up the price of new houses, a claim which was robustly denied by Housing Minister Dara O'Brien. The element of the bill which came under fire most was the shared equity scheme and its proposed price cap. Cian O'Callaghan of the Social Democrats was one of those who criticised it. The government is living on another planet if it thinks €450,000 for a home in Dublin and €400,000 in Cork and Galway is affordable. It simply is not, he said. The lead story in the Irish Independent quotes a spokesperson for the central bank saying that it continues to have concerns about the affordable housing scheme, and that paper also outlines how the shared equity scheme requires first-time buyers to repay the state loan within 5 years to avoid paying rising interest rates which kick in after the first 5 years. And an internal document circulated to housing department officials seen by the Irish Daily Mail, which reportedly says that the government won't hit its home building target until at least 2025, generates the lead story in that paper today. More than 1,300 people under the age of 65 are living wasted lives in nursing homes that are inappropriate for their needs. That's the finding of a new report due to be published today by the Ombudsman Peter Tindall, and it's the lead story in today's Irish Examiner. In Wasted Lives, Time for a Better Future for Younger People in Nursing Homes, Mr. Tindall says that systemic issues and a fractured funding model have left hundreds of people confined to nursing homes, often as a result of ill health or an accident, and often against their wishes. He's calling on the HSE to carry out a national survey and on the government to move towards ending the practice. The Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun all lead today with the death of former Republic of Ireland footballer Alan McLaughlin, who died yesterday after a long battle with cancer at the age of 54. The collapse of a case in Belfast Crown Court yesterday against two former paratroopers accused of murdering IRA member Joe McCann, who was fatally wounded while evading arrest in Belfast in 1972, is the lead story in the Irish News. The case collapsed after interviews given by both soldiers to the historical inquiries team in 2010 were deemed inadmissible. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports on a case before Belfast Magistrates Court yesterday in which 32-year-old Mark Waller of Crumlin Road, who was accused of firing shots in North Belfast, claimed that he had kept 27 guns in his garage to keep them away from the UDA. And finally, The Times runs with a picture in its front page today of Tanya Watson captured in mid-air yesterday in Tokyo, where she became Ireland's first ever female diver to qualify for the Olympic Games.
Two of Sinn Féin's MLAs in Derry have said they will not run again for election after being told to stand down by the party's leadership. Martina Anderson and Karen Mullen had both been co-opted into their seats in the Stormont Assembly. Thanking them, the party's leader Mary Lou MacDonald also said the party is on the cusp of leading government north and south. Let's talk about this and other political matters now with our political correspondent Paul Cunningham. Paul, Sinn Féin had eyed John Hume's Westminster seat for a very long time, and they finally won it with Alicia McCallion, Martina Anderson's niece, in 2017, but lost it spectacularly to the SDLP leader Colm Eastwood then in 2019. Is this electoral failure the reason Sinn Féin is being reorganised in Derry?
It's the main driver behind it. I mean, this wasn't just a bad result in 2019. It was an absolute rout when the SDLP came back under Colm Eastwood with 26,881 votes compared to Alicia McCallion, the sitting MP, with 9,771. It completely reversed what had happened before, where Sinn Féin had always been trailing. They'd managed to make it at the top. They were hoping they were going to retain that seat. And then suddenly the SDLP came thundering back and secured it. I remember being at the Sinn Féin Ardèche in November of 2019, and across the city you could see that the party had really put in an awful lot of work to try to ensure that Alicia McCallion would come through. She was relentlessly pushed on the main stage, being mentioned nearly on the hour. But there was unease within the party that the SDLP were going to come back, and that's exactly what happened the following month. So yes, this does really come down to electoral results. I mean, you could say that at times Martina was what you might call sort of unnecessarily abrasive. I remember when she was an MEP one time saying to me, I came into a meeting which was being held, as you said, from the platform, it's nice to see RT here for a change. But that said, there are plenty MLAs who you could say are unnecessarily abrasive. This really was a results-based thing, and Derry, of all cities, for them to trail in so badly triggered a review which has ultimately led to Martina Anderson standing down.
Yeah, exactly. And along with Karen Mullen, ahead of next year's Assembly vote. And Martina Anderson, convicted of conspiracy to cause explosions, jailed for life, released early under the Good Friday Agreement. It's a significant move to remove her from frontline politics.
Absolutely. She is a Republican icon and who held an electoral position. As I said, she was an MEP, she was an MLA. She'd also served in Stormont. This was someone who had absolute recognition within Republican ranks. And she gave a message last night announcing her decision. And she said that it came as a body blow after 40 years within the Republican movement that she was having to stand aside. She said that many people had contacted her and the vast majority wanted her to stay on. But the critical point was that she accepted the outcome of the party review. She was going to stand down and she was going to be supportive of this move to try and build what she called lost confidence within Derry for Sinn Féin. And at the same time, the Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald released a statement thanking Martina Anderson, but also going on to say, I acknowledge that the process of reorganisation and change is challenging, but it is my belief that our best days lie ahead in Derry. So it certainly seems that whatever about the individual recognition that she had, the party knew it had a problem and the party has moved swiftly to deal with it.
Now, Paul, an election which will happen sooner than that at Stormont, at least it's hoped anyway, is the Dublin Bay South by-election. Will we hear today if the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew, is going to stand?
Yes, she's due to be doing a radio interview on RTÉ1 at around 10 o'clock. We fully accept that or expect that she is going to announce her candidacy. It really is no secret, Audrey. Hazel Chew is going to seek the nomination to run in Dublin Bay South. But while she is a poll within her ward, another poll topper, Claire Byrne, is also going to contest it. She's someone who is very close to Eamon Ryan. She works in his constituency office. She is in the party for 16 years. So there's going to be a dust up there in Dublin Bay South for the Greens, but they're not the only ones. Fine Gael, we've got James Gagan, the councillor, he's already out of the traps. We're still waiting to find out if the former TD Kate O'Connell is going to stand. Sinn Féin also has some decisions to make. Names like Independent Senator Lynn Boylan or Fintan Warfield have been mentioned, but they also have a local councillor, Daniel Kettin, who's also standing. For Labour, Ivana Bacik seems to have a clear run, and then you've got a couple of independents. Manix Flynn is in. We're still waiting to find out if the former Justice Minister and AG Michael McDougall is going to stand.
Just finally, Paul, what the government is calling its affordable housing bill is to be published, and we're going to be talking about it to Richard Boyd Barrett in about 5 minutes' time. But what are the main points as we know them at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, basically within this affordable housing legislation, there's three main points. There's cost rental. There's going to be 414 units this year. Affordable housing on council lands, 6,000 houses within 4 years. And a shared equity scheme, as the government says, to try and give people a leg up. I mean, basically what the government feels is that there's a number of log jams within the system. And if they can get them out of the way, then you're going to have supply coming back. And that is going to drive down rents. And that is going to satisfy the pent-up demand for houses. Within the opposition ranks, they feel that this isn't radical enough. They feel they're effectively doing what Fine Gael did and failed for many years. And, you know, you can see there's a clear divide between what the government parties are advocating and what the opposition parties are saying needs to happen. The Taoiseach leading the line all the time, saying that you can't have ideology when it comes to housing. We have to do everything we possibly can. And opposition parties, including Mary Lou McDonald, saying, you've done this before and it's going to fail again. So really clear lines on this one. Whatever about housing being dropped off the radar due to COVID-19, it's roaring back, Audrey.
OK, Paul, thank you very much. Paul Cunningham.
England, Wales and parts of England will go to the polls tomorrow in the first elections there since the start of the pandemic. A by-election in the Westminster constituency of Hartlepool will also take place. In Scotland, voters will choose a new parliament. Throughout the campaign, the prospect of a fresh independence referendum has been to the fore. And this was the case again last night when the final television debate took place between the leaders of the SNP, the Conservatives, Labour, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens.
With me tonight, Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the Scottish National Party and First Minister since 2014. Elected as leader of the Scottish Conservatives less than a year ago, Douglas Ross. Anna Sarwar, the new leader of the Scottish Labour Party, the 10th since devolution.
If she gets a majority, she'll take her eye off the ball for Scotland's recovery, for rebuilding this country from this pandemic, and seek to hold another independence referendum, which the Prime Minister has said is absolutely the wrong thing to do right now in the middle of this global pandemic, to seek to divide the country all over again. And then he would then say, absolutely, the priority has to be a recovery. And Nicola Sturgeon would say, well, we'll go ahead with an illegal wildcat referendum anyway.
No, because we won't, Nicola.
OK, well, let's hear it.
So if you don't get a set
let's hear it from Nicola Sturgeon.
I know, Douglas, well, you've not perhaps had the most successful campaign, but don't start to issue smears. I would not countenance an illegal referendum, not least because it would not deliver independence. We've got to decide ourselves what kind of country do we want to be and what do we want the recovery to look like? Do we want it built in the image of Boris Johnson and Douglas Ross and their band of Brexiteers, or do we want it to be one that put a prosperous Scotland at heart?
Let me bring in Anna Sarwar.
I'm on the stage saying I don't support a referendum, I don't support independence, and I want people to choose something different. I want them to choose us to focus on a national recovery in the next parliament. That's what people are going to choose on Thursday.
These politicians are already counting down the final hours to polls opening at 7 o'clock on Thursday.
Isn't election music great? That debate hosted by the BBC Scotland political editor Glenn Campbell. We can talk now to our London editor Sean Whelan, who's in Scotland. Sean, were there any clear winners last night?
No, and nobody was really expecting clear winners from a debate like that. I mean, look, everybody knows Nicola Sturgeon is a superb political operator, brilliant communicator, and well able to handle herself, slapping down Mr. Campbell several times in some of his interventions, and the other leaders as well. But he'd set the ground rules at the start for what he called respectful debate, and it rather took that format. Everybody got their say. There were no knockout blows, because everybody knows what everybody's position is at this stage. There's been a number of these televised debates, and because of COVID, television and radio debates are really the way that this campaign has been conducted. Traditional campaigning, canvassing, knocking on doors, it's just not happening. So there is more of an emphasis on these kind of debates, and people do know what the positions are. In many ways, it's a judgment on how Nicola Sturgeon has been handling the COVID pandemic. The consensus is she's handled it rather well, probably more based on her communication skills than necessarily doing anything spectacularly different to any of the other UK regions. Certainly the death rates are not particularly brilliantly better than anywhere else, but she has contrasted her management of the public relations of it with that of Boris Johnson, and voters seem to be giving her the benefit of the doubt on that one. But as you say, the big issue undoubtedly in this campaign is a second referendum on independence for Scotland.
As you say, Sean, since Brexit and throughout the pandemic, really, the debate has simmered about the possibility of a new independence referendum. Where do things stand now?
They stand on a knife edge, Rachel, because in many ways this election is the most finely balanced and consequential of any of the elections that are taking place across Britain tomorrow. It's also in many ways the most predictable. We pretty much know that the SNP are going to be the winners of this election, in that they are going to become the biggest party once again, and therefore Nicola Sturgeon will once again be proposed as First Minister. But it's knife-edged because the SNP have set themselves a target of winning an overall majority, which in the proportional representation system that's used here in Scotland is extremely hard to do. It's been designed more or less to have cross-party coalition-type governments. Winning an overall majority is a really rare thing. It's only happened once before, 2011, under Alex Salmond's leadership. What happened then? He turned around to the then Prime Minister, David Cameron, and said, look, we have an overall majority. Our position is referendum. Give us a referendum. And Mr. Cameron did. That, the SNP say, means there's a precedent there. So if they win an overall majority at this election, they can go back to Boris Johnson and say, precedent says you have to give us another referendum. Facts on the ground have changed because of Brexit. which is another issue in this election. But because of that precedent, which is all important in the Westminster style of government, they can say, you must give it to us. And even though Boris Johnson doesn't want to give them a referendum, he will be under considerable political pressure to do so. This is the real issue in this election. Will the SNP get a majority, an outright majority on their own? And it is incredibly tight. The arithmetic really, really is going to come down to just a handful of seats and a handful of list options.
Sean, many thanks for that. Sean Whelan there, our London editor, who's in Scotland for us at the moment.
Now, putting affordability at the heart of the housing system. Those were the words of the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, as he got Cabinet support for new legislation, which he says will deliver affordable homes to both buy and rent. One of the measures in the new bill is a shared equity scheme, where the state can take a 20% equity stake in a family's first home. Apartments and houses under the scheme in Dublin and Dunleary will be capped at £500,000 and €450,000. The limit is €400,000 in Cork, Galway, Wicklow, South Dublin and Fingal. The lowest caps are in Cavan, Monaghan, Donegal, Leitrim, Sligo, Longford, Mayo and Tipperary at €225,000. There are also plans for a cost rental scheme and a requirement that all new housing developments include 10% affordable and 10% social housing. We'll speak to People Before Profit TD Richard Boyd Barrett in just a moment, but first our reporter Amy Nirieda has been speaking to house hunters about the challenges in trying to buy a home in the current market.
My name's Rachel Sullivan. We are very fortunate to live in the lovely seaside town of Greystones. We've been renting for 20 odd years. We have five children. Pre-pandemic, we were given notice to move out of our rental. We have mortgage approval for almost £500,000 and we cannot buy a house.
What kind of a house are you looking for then?
Just a four bed semi-D. From what we can see driving around, there must be about 30 properties empty. In Greystones, it looks like they are happy to leave them empty. German investors bought a huge amount of one, two and three bedroom apartments recently. And the last estate, we got an email within 40 minutes to say it had sold out. We can't get a rental in the town under £3,500 a month. Realistically, we're looking at relocating to Donegal.
My name's Kieran. I'm a teacher in Dublin and I run the Crazy House Prices Instagram account. So myself and my wife, we've been looking for a house for nearly 2 years now in Dublin, somewhere in and around where we're both from. She's from Portobello and I'm from Marino. Three beds. Most of the ones we're looking at are kind of, you know, ex-council houses. And if the new builds are totally way out of our price range, I think the closest one to us is about €900,000. So two teacher salaries, that's very, very impossible. Bidding wars have become a lot more common. So I haven't seen a house go for under asking price since November, December. People are understandably, and myself included, extremely angry about this and disheartened at the same time and just feeling like there's nothing we can do.
My name is Mary. I'm 40, about to turn 41. Currently based in Wicklow because I moved back in with my parents a couple of months ago to finish the process of saving. I saved the deposit on my own, got mortgage approval and discovered that there aren't really any houses in my budget or the houses that are in my budget are selling for 50, 60, 70 grand over asking price, which obviously I just can't compete with that.
Are you getting to the bidding days? Are you making it that far?
Not really. The top of my budget is 225. So if a house was listed at 225, it was very quickly going to 240, 250, 260. And I was just having to withdraw myself from the process.
The reality there for people at the moment trying to buy a house. Talking to our reporter Amy Nirieda, we are joined now by People Before Profit TD Richard Boyd Barrett. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the government says for the first time in over a decade, local authorities will deliver affordable homes on their own lands. And Dara O'Brien says there'll be 6,000 new homes within 4 years. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, that's 1,500 houses roughly a year, which compared to the scale of the problem and with about, I would say, about 80% of working people priced out of the market by these cuckoo funds, it's just pathetic in terms of numbers. But then when you look at the prices of the so-called affordable housing, we discover that in the areas where the crisis is most acute, where housing is most unaffordable, the affordable housing will be completely unaffordable for anybody who's earning less than between 90,000 and 120,000 euros. So
When you consider that average earnings in this country are about 39,000 euro a year, essentially this scheme offers nothing for the vast, vast majority of working people. Even the affordable housing will be completely unaffordable. And to my mind, this is because once again, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are kowtowing to the property developers who are unwilling to provide housing at a level that is actually affordable for ordinary working people.
And in relation to rental properties, as we know that the cost of rent here has been so high over the last good number of years at this point. Now, this cost rental scheme, they say there'll be over 400 such tenancies in place this year. I mean, how much do you expect that will reduce average rents by?
Well, to be honest, we don't really know, because when you look at the LDA bill,
that's the Land Development Agency,
so-called cost rental and the so-called affordable housing to purchase are going to be benchmarked against local market conditions and will be a slight discount on those local market conditions. So it won't actually be based on the cost of building, it'll be based on local market conditions. So once again, in the areas where rents are the highest, where house prices are the highest, the rent will only be a small discount. Now, if you take an area like Dunleary, you're talking about rents these days of 2,500 euro. We've just heard one of your contributors talking about Greystones over 3,000. So once again, it would appear in the way that both the affordable housing scheme and the LDA bill are being set up, that the cost rental will actually be unaffordable for huge numbers of people. It's also not clear who will be eligible for it. So really, this is, it's just a bad joke what the government are talking about, and it becomes even worse when you consider that the LDA bill, what's going to be done on public land, is essentially bring private finance in on public land. So we won't only have unaffordable rents on private sites, we will now have unaffordable rents and prices on public land.
Just a final question to you. On this programme yesterday, Dara O'Brien was talking about the international or national investment funds which purchase properties for people to rent. And he was saying that there are times when it is appropriate that it happen. Do you believe that is true? Does it increase the supply of social homes to rent, a supply that can't currently be met without them, perhaps?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the only houses that are being delivered are ones now that, because no actual council housing is being built. In the case of Dunleary, zero council houses were built last year, incredibly, 7 or 8 years into the housing crisis. But what the Cuckoo funds are doing are leasing back properties that they bought. They come in and buy whole swathes, pricing ordinary buyers out. Then they lease these houses back at extortionate cost to the council. So even if the council gets some, or the AHBs maybe get some of these houses for social housing tenants, it's costing the state an absolute fortune. And of course, the Cuckoo funds can exit the arrangement after a specified period of time. So, I mean, really, this is the worst of all possible worlds. And it would seem that the government are doing anything but actually building itself public and affordable housing that people can actually afford.
Okay.
And the only winners in all of this are the Cuckoo funds, the international investment funds, and property speculators.
Thank you very much indeed. Richard Boyd-Barrett, People Before Profit, TD.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 7:38, it's good morning to Darren.
Good morning, Audrey, and some fantastic news to begin with this morning, with news that Oliver Dingley, the Irish diver, is heading back to the Olympic Games. He's competing at the Diving World Cup and has just finished 15th in the 3-metre springboard preliminary round. He advances to the semi-finals, but by doing that, he qualifies for his second Games. Ollie finished in 8th place overall in Rio 5 years ago, and he joins Tanya Watson, who qualified yesterday. Tanya actually is back in action on the board later this morning. Manchester City booked a place in the Champions League final after a 2-0 win against PSG last night. City go through 4-1 over the two legs, And the lineup for that final will be completed tonight. And will we have an all English decider? It's Chelsea against Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge. And Chelsea are in the driving seat. It's 1-1 from the first meeting, but Chelsea have that away goal. But it's the first European final for City in 51 years. And their manager, Pep Guardiola, is back in a final for the first time in a decade.
Yeah, the people believe it's easy to ride the Champions League. Always, the people believe because happened in the past, they have to arrive every year in the season in the final of the Champions League. So, unfortunately, getting the final Champions League now makes sense what we have done the last 4 years or 5 years with a lot of people. This is a little bit unfair, you know, because every day the consistent these guys have shown during the last 4 years in all competition, this is remarkable. Because I said before, so we want, this competition is like this, we won the first game because of the shoot between the hips for the opening. And today was a post from Marquinhos, and maybe the penalty is given, when it's, of course, not penalty, but it's given. And you are out from these little details. So United won a Champions League because Terry is sleepy, you know? United won in the last minutes in Camp Nou against Bayern Munich, this competition. So Madrid won against the Atletico Madrid in 93 minutes. So it's a competition that is so difficult. The stars, they are involved in that. But we won 11 games. I think this competition, just withdrawn Oporto, we make an incredible Champions League, and now we have 3 weeks to prepare the final.
Yeah, sometimes you need a bit of luck, but City don't need luck this season. They are absolutely flying it. Now, we got some very sad news yesterday with the passing of former Irish international Alan McLaughlin. He died at the age of just 54. He earned 42 caps for Ireland between 1990 and 1999. We're going to pay a very special tribute to him on the show a little bit later on. But last night on our coverage of the Champions League, Damien Duff paid this tribute to Alan and to the other Alan, Alan Keeley, a former League of Ireland player who died at the age of 38.
Alan was an absolute gentleman, a class act. We kind of overlapped as I was starting off. He was finishing off. And him and quite a few others are inspired the generations. The reason why I played football with his goal, qualifying us for the 94 World Cup, that famous night in Windsor Park. I remember distinctly where I was. It's probably why Richie plays football and many other Irish players. So a very sad day, and I'd have to say a very sad day for Dermot Keeley as well. I know him, he was my teacher in school, business studies, a great character. No father should bury their son. So yeah, very sad day, and we send condolences to both families.
Yeah, and we second that. Thoughts with all their family and friends. Finally, the government has confirmed that non-playing panel members will be allowed to attend GAA games when the competitions resume this weekend. The GAA will discuss this development as they prepare to finalise the return-to-play protocols. Inter-county challenge matches will be permitted from next Monday. I'll be back in an hour.
Now, where is your local vaccination centre and how do you plan on travelling there when you get the call? For some people in Limerick, that journey is proving to be a difficult one. Our reporter Joan O'Sullivan has been looking at this. Joan, what's the problem?
Well, in Limerick, the vaccination centre for Limerick City and County is located on the outskirts of the city at the Radisson Blu Hotel. In fact, it's officially in County Clare. Now, there are no concerns about how the centre itself is functioning in terms of how it's delivering the vaccine, but worries are being expressed about the accessibility of the centre if you happen to be travelling by public transport. A local group in the city has highlighted that only one public service bus route from Limerick City brings you to the centre. It operates once an hour and it drops you off at a bus stop on the opposite side of the road from the centre. Now, the road in question happens to be a four-lane dual carriageway. This is Madeline Lies of the Limerick Pedestrian Network, and she explains how one of their members came across an elderly couple waiting at a bus stop near the centre at the weekend.
They had to get to this vaccination centre, which is about 7.5 kilometres from the city centre. They are pensioners on small incomes and no car. They weren't able to walk at their age, but also there are no paths along that way, so no one can walk to the centre safely. They inquired about a taxi, but were quoted €17 each way and couldn't afford the round-trip fare, which is pretty steep. So they decided that they would look into a bus, which is what they ended up doing. The bus goes once an hour, and then when you arrive, you're dropped off on the wrong side of the dual carriageway. There's no pedestrian crossing, there's no way of slowing traffic. So these two elderly people had to make their way across 100 kilometre per hour dual carriageway to cross the road.
So this couple, Joan, they had to cross the four-lane dual carriageway to go over to the hotel, the vaccination centre. And then when they were finished, they had to wait at the side of the road. It's the main Limerick-Galway road for an hourly bus service to travel home.
That's exactly it. Now, the Limerick Pedestrian Network publicised their story on social media and it got quite a strong reaction. It prompted a lot of questions and concerns. Here's Madeline again summing up some of the reaction that she received.
We have groups of people who are really excited to try and get their vaccinations and we're making it much harder for them. And then we have large groups of people or groups of people who might be kind of on the fence about the whole thing and who certainly, you know, wouldn't go to the effort to take a half day off work to try and struggle out to the outskirts when they can't do it more easily somewhere closer to them. I think a lot of people asking, why did this place get chosen and how do you kind of figure out what a better option might be?
So why was the centre put there, Joan? Because as we've been saying, it is quite a distance from the centre of the city. And are any efforts being made to try and tackle the problems that have arisen?
Well, I was speaking to Sinn Féin TD Maurice Quinlivan, and he said that that's a question he's asked of both the government and the HSE recently. I spoke to him last night and he explained why he feels a second vaccination centre in the city centre would be the best solution.
There's better locations, I believe, in the city centre of Limerick. There's a, in the university, there's a centre that we used for an overfill in the first phase of COVID. There's also a HSE other facility that was used for walking testing. All of those would be accessible by either public transport or for walking for a lot of people. Whilst I don't want to say it closed the Radisson is fine, it's working really well. We do need a second centre where people will be accessible for. And if that's not the case, then the government have to intervene and provide some sort of transfer for people who don't have their own, you know, private cars or whatever. And I unfortunately had to deal with a number of people who came to my constituency clinic and it would be elderly people who didn't necessarily have relatives close by and who couldn't afford the taxi fare out there. I know one of the local community centres helped out for a number of cases.
Sinn Féin TD Maurice Quinlivan. Joan, has there been any further reaction?
Well, the UL Hospitals Group have governance over the site and they gave us a statement last night. In that statement, they said that locations for vaccination centres are chosen for a number of reasons. Now, that includes their overall flow area and flow management needed for the scale of the operation. Things like general external access and traffic management flow to the site itself and also the availability of public transport insofar as possible. Now, in the statement, they said, we are aware of concerns raised locally regarding public transport access to the site. As we prepare to significantly increase the number of vaccinations administered in the coming weeks, we are reviewing all aspects of the operation of the centre.
Joan, many thanks for that.
Now, the numbers returning to work are slowly growing. Over 385,000 people are receiving the pandemic unemployment payment. That's down 18,000 on last week and falling below 400,000 for the first time this year. But for those whose job no longer exists, it can be very difficult to find work. And the longer someone is unemployed, as we know, the more challenging it is. Women and young people in particular are affected. More of them lost their jobs and more women gave up their careers to mind their children during the lockdown. With that in mind, a course run in Cork called Growing Your Potential aims to give a confidence and skills boost to women who are considering going back to work. Jill Steadman reports.
People would say to you all the time when you say you're a homemaker, oh, you don't work. So in addition to losing perspective on myself, I suppose I had felt unvalued and unproductive.
Anne-Marie O'Gorman has stayed at home for the past 20 years as a homemaker. She is now over halfway through the 10-week Growing Your Potential course.
I've moved from this, I'm an ordinary woman, nothing special, nothing grand. And now I've kind of gone on to, I'm actually who I'm meant to be. This is me.
But before taking part, Anne-Marie had many concerns about returning to the paid working environment.
I questioned, what could I do? Who would actually employ me? And actually, who am I? I actually realised this course was made for where I was at. This course was actually a little piece of magic that had come into my life. And I really do feel like that it sprinkled magic dust on me. And now I want to listen to Andrew Day singing Rise Up. And I just feel so excited about life now. and about the future.
The course aims to give women a confidence and skills boost. It covers a number of areas, as Siobhan O'Neill, the course leader, explains.
A personal development, CV preparation and interview skills. We have three career coaching sessions. We do personal presentation for interview in the workplace, what you might or might not wear if you were going for an interview and working in the workplace. And also communication and customer care.
The programme also helps women to identify the skills they already have.
And some people say, I've only been in the home. And you're like, oh my God. You're like, first of all, rearing children is one of the most important jobs on the planet because you're rearing the next generation. So like, that's huge.
Grainne O'Driscoll is one of the trainers on the course.
The skill set from managing homes and from managing budgets and managing timetables, and you know, there's an unbelievable skill set that is there that is hugely transferable within the work environment.
You know, I'm a manager at home. Before I even go out the door, I'm first aider. You know, I mean, as a mother, you wear so many hats, and then when you sit down to talk to somebody, you think, yeah, of course I could do that.
Arlene Pope finished the Growing Your Potential course at Christmas. She has since gone on to complete a special needs assistance course.
This is about taking back a bit of your life for you. Like a friend of mine, when I told her I was doing the course and, you know, that I'd finished my SNA course, and I said, God, you know, am I too old like to be changing direction? And she said, let me just quote you now from this wonderful poet. She said, her name is Mary Oliver. And her quote was, now, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And I just thought, you know what? It is one wild and precious life, and I deserve to do all the things that I want to do with it. So if I can gain that confidence from doing the course, I think every single woman should.
Arlene Pope ending that report by Jill Steadman. And the course is free and applications are now open for the next round of an online program.
Brian Finn joins us with the business news.
Well, while much of the focus, Rachel, of Ulster Bank's as well as KBC's possible departure from the market has been on the consumer, we're going to take a look at how businesses might fare in this new banking landscape. John Finn, Managing Director with Treasury Solutions, is on the line. Problems are plenty for firms at the moment, John, but does this impending departure of these two names have much of an impact on business banking?
Good morning, Brian. Yes, it does, Brian, because less competition means probably higher pricing and challenges in certain particular sectors. And actually, it can be bad for the banks too. Off the record, they'll probably admit that it can lead to complacency. So if I was to summarise it in a couple of areas in particular, Brian, hospitality is a challenge for anybody who's a customer of Ulster Bank or KBC, because they'll need a good summer to be able to show that they have good accounts to move to another bank. Deposits clearly are a problem because the banks don't want them and there are negative deposit rates pretty much everywhere. And the third area which I'm concerned about actually is what I would say mid-sized loans, mid-sized corporates, loans of 2 to 10 million. Because what happens is if you borrow more than 10 million, you're in the corporate banking scene, you get a personalized service. If you borrow less than 2 million, you're in the SME space. But that 2 to 10 million space, you need better customer service. You actually need lending people in the banks. The banks are cutting people back. And that part of the economy is crucial because they're the engine drivers going forward. So there's a number of different areas of the economy right now that I think are suffering and will suffer unless PTSB in particular begin to emerge as a third banking force.
Indeed, and without Ulster and KBC, we'd be down to those two main lenders and permanent TSB if it can scale up to those aspirations. There are non-bank lenders there, but how do we compare internationally in this new environment?
Pricing is a problem, and we've seen that in the last while. It's a problem anyway because of a legacy of the last financial crisis. You know, without getting too technical, it's got to do with capital reserves and I suppose in loan loss ratios and stuff in the past. But that is a problem. And of course, if you have less competition, well, pricing tends to go up anyway. And as I said to you, the ability to lend to the parts of the economy that we need to grow to drive our economic growth in the future becomes also important. And if they're not well served, then you have not just a disadvantage for those companies, but you have a wider disadvantage for the whole economy.
Inflation is a question that's been rearing its head in the US in particular, and we heard Janet Yellen saying last night that interest rates may have to rise in the US to keep the economy from overheating. Is this an issue that should be of concern to us here?
Yeah, I think we've got to become more alert now. It's almost a perfect situation in many respects now. If you look at it, you've got pent-up demand. Economic growth across the board this year globally is going to be very strong. You have got high deposit rates, and high deposits, I should say, in a lot of countries. You have large government stimulus across the globe. I mean, America has a huge infrastructure stimulus and a huge, I suppose, pandemic check writing by Joe Biden. And commodities are up an awful lot, Brian. I mean, timber prices are up 50% this year. Oil prices are up 40%. That drives up house prices in one way or another. We've got pent-up demand for houses. And it's the danger actually here now is that if you look back to where we were at the beginning of the noughties, you know, we are actually performing very well economically here vis-a-vis the rest of Europe. So demand is very strong. We've definitely seen strong inflationary pressures coming through. That would tend to lead or want an increase in interest rates. But of course, if the Eurozone is not growing as fast as up, they may not rise as quickly here as they will in the States or in the UK. So it's a challenge for the government because at the same time, they're also pumping money into the economy to make sure that we come out of the pandemic, but they don't want to put too much in to overheat the economy. So it's quite a challenge.
John Finn, thank you very much indeed.
The government's bid to tackle the housing crisis, a new report on the number of people under the age of 65 living in nursing homes, and the death of Republic of Ireland footballer Alan McLaughlin are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the fierce opposition which the Affordable Housing Bill met in the Dáil yesterday, with opposition TDs insisting that it will push up the price of new houses, a claim which was robustly denied by Housing Minister Dara O'Brien. The element of the bill which came under fire most was the shared equity scheme and its proposed price cap. Cian O'Callaghan of the Social Democrats was one of those who criticised it. The government is living on another planet if it thinks €450,000 for a home in Dublin and €400,000 in Cork and Galway is affordable. It simply is not, he said. The lead story in the Irish Independent quotes a spokesperson for the central bank saying that it continues to have concerns about the affordable housing scheme. And that paper also outlines how the shared equity scheme requires first-time buyers to repay the state loan within 5 years to avoid paying rising interest rates, which kick in after the first 5 years. And an internal document circulated to housing department officials seen by the Irish Daily Mail, which reportedly says that the government won't hit its home building target until at least 2025, generates the lead story in that paper today. That report from the Ombudsman, Peter Tindall, on the number of people under the age of 65 living in nursing homes provides the lead story in today's Irish Examiner. And the Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun all lead today with the death of former Republic of Ireland footballer Alan McLaughlin, who died yesterday at the age of 54. The collapse of a case in Belfast Crown Court yesterday against two former paratroopers accused of murdering IRA member Joe McCann, who was fatally wounded while evading arrest in Belfast in 1972, is the lead story in the Irish News. The case collapsed after interviews given by both soldiers to the Historical Inquiries Team in 2010 were deemed inadmissible. The Belfast Telegraph also gives front page coverage to that story, while the picture on the front of today's paper is of Edwin Poots and Geoffrey Donaldson in celebratory mode at a previous election. The caption notes that May 14th is the date that the DUP will decide which of the two men will become its new leader. Writing in today's Times, meanwhile, Cathy Sheridan gives her assessment of that leadership contest under the headline, Donaldson and Poots like bald men arguing over a comb. Elsewhere this morning, healthcare staff who refuse to be vaccinated face redeployment, while staff who fail to confirm they are vaccinated could be moved out of patient contact under proposals being examined by the HSE. That's on the front of the Times, as is an action picture of Tanya Watson in Tokyo yesterday, where she became Ireland's first ever female diver to qualify for the Olympic Games. Back in the front of the Examiner, there's an aerial view picture taken at the site of the Metro Bridge, which collapsed in Mexico City on Monday, which so far has resulted in the loss of more than 20 lives. Liam Collins has a nice article in today's Independent on Kathleen Reynolds, the wife of the late former Taoiseach Albert Reynolds, who died at her home in Dublin at the age of 88. And finally, Kitty Holland has a piece in today's Times about a selection of handwritten letters composed by Republican prisoners in the H Block and Armagh Women's Prison in the lead up to the 1981 hunger strikes, which have been found in County Kerry and are to be handed over to the University of Limerick's History Department later this month. One of the signatories of the letters is Marcella, which we're told was the pen name of Bobby Sands, who died 40 years ago today after 66 days on hunger strike.
A report by the Ombudsman published this morning highlights the lack of support for younger people with disabilities who are living in nursing homes. Peter Tindall says the homes are not appropriate for those under the age of 65. His report, called Wasted Lives, finds that many people did not have a meaningful say in their admission and that their needs are not being met. We've been talking to two people affected by this issue. First, Julia, who has a spinal cord injury. She used to live in a nursing home, but now lives independently.
I had a spinal cord injury and I spent a couple of months in Beaumont Hospital, and then I went to the National Rehabilitation Hospital, and I already spent a long time there because basically I had nowhere else to go. And then someone found a nursing home for me. So here I am with a fresh acquired spinal cord injury and going to a nursing home in my late 30s. My first day, it was horrible. I went to the dining room and it wasn't like in the rehab where people talk to each other. It wasn't like this. No one said anything. No one talked. And I just went back to my room and I just cried. And I said, look, I don't belong here. I was in there for 12 years. I came there in September 2008 and I left last June. See, in the first couple of years, I nearly gave up on myself and I let myself go. I gained weight and did nothing. But then I hit a stage where I said, look, no, you can't go on like this. So I started working on myself. I lost weight, tried to get a bit fitter. And more friends said, Julia, you don't belong there. We're not going to visit you there anymore. Let's meet outside. So in all this, and I said, yeah, no, let's do this. Let's start fighting to get out of here. And that's what we did. I live in my own little apartment in Swords, and I'm so happy. I have a sofa now I can sit on and watch telly, or, you know, I can invite friends over in a nice atmosphere. I can make them a cup of coffee. We can sit down, we can have a chat, we can, you know, it's in a nice environment.
Julia. Well, John Paul was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2014. He's been living in a nursing home for the past 3 years.
I started to deteriorate. Gone from crutches to Zimmer frame to wheelchair in the space of 7 or 8 years or so. I've been in the nursing home 2 years in Kerry, St. Joseph's in Kenmare, and I've been a year here in Dublin. I'm 55. For me, like, the way I think about it is, it's a lot better than being homeless, but being crippled is very restrictive. You need help from other people. Like, there's no two ways about that. But living in the nursing home, it's a dead loss to me, like, you know, regards to goals and aims and options in life type of way. Like, it's hard to explain. It's like living in a nursing home is pretty much lack of independence. It's demoralizing. It's the same old, same old. Same thing every day. Like, you know, it's up to the day space, down to your room, spend time on your iPad, go around the building. It's pretty much a routine that isn't a routine. It's been incarcerated in a way, like, it's like you're indoors most of the time. Well, I have been for since March, pretty much indoors all the time. I've been out very seldom. It's an institutionalized situation.
And thanks to John Paul and Julia for telling us their stories. The Ombudsman, Peter Tindall, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
How many people are in this position, and why did you decide to look at their cases?
There are more than 1,300 people under 65 in nursing homes in Ireland. Nobody knows the exact number because there's no tracking of them once they go in. We looked at it because four people came to us with complaints, but when we started to look at those complaints, it was obvious to us that there were systemic problems and therefore it needed a wider investigation.
What then did people say to you about their lives? Because listening there to both Julia and John Paul, there's this immense sense of people not being allowed to fulfil their potential.
Yes, people were deeply, deeply sad about what had happened to them. You couldn't but be moved by the circumstances in which people found themselves. Their autonomy was taken away from them. It's not a criticism of the nursing homes particularly, but these were people who should have been out living in their own homes in the community. And as you heard there, when people are given that opportunity, they can thrive, they can be active, engaged citizens. But we had a system where they couldn't find any way out. They couldn't find access to support. Some of them even had adapted accommodation available to them, but they couldn't get funding for the support they needed in order to live in it.
Right, so the accommodation was there. It wasn't as though there was nowhere better for people to live.
Oh no, in some instances people had homes to go to, but there was no support that would have enabled them to live there. Obviously in some instances people will need accommodation. But for instance, we had one person where a charity had identified a house and had adapted it. It had been adapted with input from the person concerned to be suitable for his purposes, but when the time came, there was no funding to enable him to move there.
Were people's individual needs and rights considered, or was there a tendency to treat people basically as a problem?
I think in reality, people were forgotten more than ignored. I think once people were in the nursing home, there was no great pressure to do anything to move them onto a more appropriate setting. So consequently, there was no real systematic approach to establishing who they were, what their requirements were, what their wishes and preferences were, and having a plan that would enable those wishes and preferences to be put into practice.
You also say that a considerable number of people, that they weren't adequately consulted about what they wanted.
A number of the people we spoke to were very clear that they thought they were going in for a temporary stay and then found themselves still there years later. It was clear to us that people's wishes and preferences weren't being taken into account, and that quite often people had not consented to a long-term stay in a nursing home, but nonetheless that's where they found themselves.
So what then are the alternatives? Because clearly some people need more support than others. What should be happening?
Well, what needs to happen in the first instance is we need to establish the detailed picture of who's in nursing homes at the moment under 65 and what their preferences and needs are. Then we need to have an action plan which allows the government to put sufficient funding in to enable people to move out. We also need, while people are still there, to give them the support they need to have a more fulfilling life, or at least to have access to some more age-appropriate activities. And then finally, we need to be doing something that stops people being admitted long-term to nursing homes inappropriately.
I'm looking at a statement we received last night from the Department of Health and from the Minister with responsibility in this area, Anne Rabbitt. It points out that the Programme for Government promises to tackle this problem. Has there been any progress, do you know?
There is progress and we're delighted by it. When the Programme for Government was being drafted, we realised that the report, which was delayed because of COVID, wouldn't be out in time to influence that. So we directly contacted the parties and asked them to give some consideration to the issues that we were seeing arising in the course of the investigation. So consequently, there is to be a pilot project, which we're delighted about, which will take 18 people out of nursing homes. But as you can understand, with 1,300 people there, 18 is a start, but there needs to be considerably more investment. The other thing that's been happening is that the funding system is biased towards institutional care. So whereas there's a statutory scheme for nursing home support, there's no statutory scheme as yet for supporting people to live in the community. Now, there's a commitment from government to introduce such a scheme, and that would be another important step. And finally, there is now a commitment to looking at the needs of those 1,300 people, and hopefully from that we will see the action plan that we need in order to allow those people to move out.
Sorry, go on.
I just want to say, during the course of the investigation, four of the people who we spoke to sadly passed away during the pandemic. And I think it's important we understand that this matter should be tackled with urgency. People's lives are being wasted as we speak. So while it's good that things are moving, they need to move quickly.
And were these then younger people living in nursing homes? Did they catch COVID while they were in the nursing homes?
We don't know the precise circumstances. Mm-hmm. At least one of them died from COVID, but four of them died from the commencement of the investigation since we spoke to them before the report was published.
Just one final thought from something you were saying there about this financial bias towards institutional care. Is that a broader issue, as in are there also a lot of older people who find that that's a problem?
Yes, indeed. One of the things I should be clear about is we looked at the particular issue of people under 65 in nursing homes. We're not making any conclusion that people over 65 are properly accommodated there. There may well be many who would prefer to be living at home, but weren't able to access the support they needed in order to enable them to do that. So I think we've a long tradition, sadly, of looking to institutional care to solve the problems of needing to support people. But I think we need to look beyond that now and to start looking at people from their own perspective, see what their aspirations are, and making sure that we respect their human rights and that they have choice as to how they live their lives.
Peter Tindall, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
The French ambassador to Ireland has described the mandatory hotel quarantine system here as unfair and unnecessarily harsh. Vincent Guérin joins us now. Mr. Ambassador, good morning and you're welcome to the programme. Why do you say that?
Good morning, Audrey, and thank you for the invitation. Indeed, I think it's worth recalling that this mandatory hotel quarantine is in place since 5th of April for France, as for Belgium, Luxembourg and Italy. And during these 3 weeks, we've been faced here at the embassy with a large number of desperate calls by the French community in Ireland, which is 25 to 30,000 strong. And I think the people who listen to this program have to understand that many of those French people commute between Ireland and France as people would commute between the north and the south of the island. That's one of the benefits of the EU. They go for France for medical reasons. They have left children, parents across the border. And we no longer speak for normal traveling. It's not business as usual. People go for really compelling reasons, for severe medical treatment, for cancer, for heart disease. And we believe that the mandatory hotel quarantine basically prevents almost all traveling, and that the exception mechanism which has been put in place is really insufficient. I think press reports showed that only 10% of the cases have been accepted. And so people also have to realize, I believe, that Ireland is the only member state in Europe to have imposed such a restrictive and, we believe, extreme measure. So what we would ask here is really to see whether this measure cannot be lifted in a matter of weeks rather than a matter of months. And we really believe that there should be an exemption mechanism which allows for more exception and which also would be prior to the systems, because currently you have to register the mandatory quarantine scheme. You have to go to the hotel before being able to appeal, and that yes. is something which many people will not want to take the risk of.
Now, there is an exemption in place for people who have to travel for critical medical treatment. We've been talking to one French man. He's living here. He wants to visit his home country to see his father, who's dying, but he doesn't know if he will be granted an exemption from quarantine on compassionate grounds. Let's hear from him. He is Johan Pansede.
My father is dying from a cancer, and he's expected to pass away in the next few days. So I want to go back in France at his funeral, and I am very concerned about the hotel quarantine. I think there should be an exemption for people in my situation. I am expected to bury my father and then spend 2 weeks alone in a hotel room. I think it should be compassionate to allow me to quarantine at home with my wife and my four children. I am also concerned that you can't appeal in hotel quarantine before arrival. It's very stressful, especially in this type of condition. And I really think it's inhuman. My mother, my sisters are in France, and they are close to my father. They are with him, but it's very stressful for them too, because we have a lot of things to manage. And you can understand this one is not something easy to deal with. And I am alone on this one.
That's Johan Ponsiday there. And undoubtedly, Mr. Ambassador, there are very hard cases like that, people directly affected. But France closed its borders to non-EU countries in January. It has recently banned all flights to and from Brazil. Germany closed its borders to Austria and the Czech Republic earlier this year. Other EU countries did too. They're making the decision to protect their people.
True. The big difference is that France, for example, never closed any country with any EU member states. From the beginning, we said very clearly that the freedom of movement within the EU was core, and that we should let people move as freely as possible within the EU, but indeed close the border to the rest of the world. And we have indeed imposed, in certain cases, PCR testing or quarantine at home, but never mandatory hotel quarantine in a hotel. I think no other member states have done so. And including some of the cases you mentioned of member states, I think there were always exception for compelling cases as the one we just heard.
Yes, but essential travel and exceptional cases don't give you immunity from the virus. And France's 14-day average is currently 652 per 100,000. In the 2 weeks up until May the 3rd, there were 360,000 cases. And there are some variants there as well. So doesn't the Irish government have a duty to protect the people living here?
Yes, certainly. We know that it's challenging for all governments. But there may be other ways through quarantine at home, through more testing, through checking that the quarantine at home is duly respected, that are, I believe, more respectful of indeed some very specific and humanitarian cases.
Well, the Irish government is meant to respond to the Commission, write to the Commission later today to give its reasons for why particular countries are on their mandatory hotel quarantine list. So we will await that. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning. That is the French ambassador to Ireland, Vincent Guirand.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 8:36, it's good morning again to Darren.
Hello again, Audrey, and some great news this morning. Irish diver Oliver Dingley has qualified for the Olympic Games. Ali, competing at the Diving World Cup in Tokyo this morning, he finished 15th in the 3-metre springboard preliminary round, and that result means he's guaranteed himself a place in Tokyo. I was on air yesterday when news came through that Tanya Watson booked her place in Tokyo, making history, becoming the first female to get to the Olympics in this particular event. Well, 5 years ago, Ali finished 8th at the Rio Olympics, and he was the first male competing in the diving since 1948. And so good to have two of them now to keep each other company in the Olympic Games this coming summer. Tanya, incidentally, back in action as we speak. She's competing in the 10-metre platform semi-finals. More on that throughout the day. Manchester City booked a place in the Champions League final. 2-0 winners last night against PSG. 4-1 victors over the two legs. Kyle Walker says it was a dream come true to make the final.
Obviously, boy from Sheffield, it's what you dream about. It's what I was dreaming about, you know, when we got the good victory over there, and to actually make it come true, it's, you know, as I say, it's a dream come true, and I'm buzzing. To finally go over there, get the, you know, the victory, and I think the well-earned victory, and definitely in the second half performance, and then come here and beat them 2-0, keep a clean sheet, which I'm more than happy about, is, you know, it's full credit to this squad.
Now, the lineup for that final will be completed tonight. Chelsea meet Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge. It's 1-1 from the first leg. We got some very sad news yesterday with the passing of former Irish international Alan McLaughlin. Alan passed away at the age of just 54. And this morning on the programme, we're going to pay a very special tribute to him. He earned 42 caps for Ireland between 1990 and 1999. But he'll be best remembered as the one who scored that all-important equaliser against Northern Ireland to send us to the 1994 World Cup in America.
Comes straight out to McLaughlin! It's there! Alan McLaughlin has done it! He could not believe it! He looked for the linesman's flag!
Come out to me, chested it, left foot, sweet, ran the bottom corner.
Your first goal for Ireland, was
it? First goal, and obviously the most important goal. That one's for me wife and my little girl at home, Abby. And obviously for all the supporters here tonight, all the people in the bars and in the clubs back in Ireland. That was for them.
Yes, what a night that was. November 17th, 1993. Hard to believe for some of us that that was almost 30 years ago. And what a moment as well to give the nation a lift when we really needed it. Alan was from Manchester. He was born to Irish parents. And he actually got the call up to represent Ireland and England at the same time. His mum was from Knocknaderry in Limerick. And his dad is from a place called Largan between Headford and Tuam. And he was selected for both B squads for both countries. But he chose Ireland as a tribute to the support he got from his mum growing up and the encouragement he got from her to play football. And I think that moment alone sums up the guy he was. I've been talking to Irish legend Paddy Bonner, and he's been remembering a former teammate and friend.
Yes, Darren, it's a really sad day to hear the news about Alan. Alan was one of the very, very good guys in the squad, sat in the background at times, but was a lovely personality to be around. What an impact he had then thereafter when he was called upon. I think he was probably a manager's dream type of player. You knew that he could do the business when called upon, but he never gave him any trouble, Jack, any trouble whatsoever. Spoke to him afterwards when he had the first operation, and he had great hope then that everything would be okay. Obviously, it hasn't worked out that way. Condolences to the family and all his close friends. But he'll be remembered. He'll remember for that night in Windsor Park. There's no doubt about it. But I think we as a group probably remember him as the personality that he was, the good guy that he was. If you speak to any of the staff or you speak to the players and talk about Alan, they all talk about him very, very fondly indeed. Just it's a real, real pity. 54 years old, too young for that to happen. It's a sad one for everybody concerned.
He amassed over 40 caps for his country, but he'll always be remembered for that one goal, that November night, Windsor Park, 1993, the equaliser against Northern Ireland, which took us to the World Cup in America in 1994. Do you recall what that goal meant to Alan McLaughlin?
Yeah, listen, it's not often, somebody who's, you could call him as a backup player in many ways, a squad player, to come off a bench, but to make such an impact. We were really struggling on the night. Jimmy Quinn had scored that goal. We needed a bit of inspiration. Alan, who was a busy player in the middle of the pitch, but he got himself into a brilliant position to go and had a great strike to get us back in the game. And I know that over the years, when people talk about the great moments in Irish sport and the people that was responsible for them, they put Alan right up there because it got us to a World Cup in Ireland. It put him in there among the Ray Houghtons of this world and so on. And I know he appreciated it because he loved his country. He loved coming over. He loved playing and being part of the squad and part of the team. And sometimes when you do contribute and you make such an impression and impact, then that lives with you for the rest of your days. And he would have been a very, very happy man about that. When we got together and had a few pints and that, he probably regaled in that. And people bought him a few pints along the way too for what he achieved. So, listen, live with him and his family people will talk about it forevermore.
Thanks for the memories, Alan McLaughlin. Thoughts with your family and friends wherever they are.
The government has begun a public consultation which will inform a national anti-racism strategy expected to be published this year. But is there a need for a national conversation before that plan comes into force? In the second report in a series exploring racism in Ireland, our social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally has been speaking to people across sport, the arts and media.
Emer O'Neill is one of Ireland's top basketball players. The sport gave her a sense of inclusion and achievement from a young age.
I always felt different, like the odd one out, because I was. Very clearly, like in my group of friends, like I was in a school of 800 girls and I was the only person of colour in the whole school, you know. But when I played basketball, it didn't matter what colour I was, as long as I was putting the ball in the basket. And I loved that feeling of belonging. To be honest, I don't recall much issues in sport when it comes to racism. Like, every now and then the N-word would, you know, be whispered maybe under someone's breath or whatever, but it didn't really affect me. I loved what I did, so, you know, no one was going to get me down in that sense.
Sport has offered a platform to those from minority backgrounds for years, but athletes are experiencing increasing levels of racism online.
Don't scroll by when you see hate online. Call it out. Delete, ban, report.
So initiatives like this by Team Ireland ahead of the Olympics is hugely important in showing support and zero tolerance. Heather Boyle is head of communications.
It is inevitable that when we go to events like this and you have the high profile, that a small minority of the comments will be negative, but a small minority is not good enough. And I think as an organisation, when we are, you know, when we're Team Ireland, when we're going to such a big games like this, where equality and respect is at the heart of what we do, I think we have to take a stand. And I think that us as an organisation and us as athletes who are role models in the community, we have to stand up tall. So, you know, maybe it mightn't be for even just the athletes who are within our group, who are performing well and who are, you know, are achieving results, who have made it to Team Ireland. What it is it's making a very strong statement that in all sports, at all levels, from grassroots all the way up to potential Team Ireland members, that this is not something we tolerate.
Ala Boussier is a freelance filmmaker and photographer. She, like others in the arts, is giving a platform to many communities.
My work is around social justice and bringing awareness around political situation or things that community would face. So I talk about racism, I talk about the war on terror, I'll talk about the discriminations that asylum seekers would face and so on, and try my best to get their stories through my art or through my filmmaking.
Ala says racism, shielded by humour, is still racism.
A person looks at you and then they'll give you that some stereotype joke and you'll be like, it's not a joke, it's something serious that you shouldn't be saying and everything. But then you'll get, oh, but we're Irish, we like to joke around, we like to make a laugh out of something. And that needs to change within the Irish community. As much as I am Irish, that's the one thing that it kind of annoys me.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 2 of season 2.
Girl Media was established by UL PhD student Mamobo Ogoru. She wanted to dissect social issues that affect Ireland's multicultural generation and create more understanding. She believes that now is the time for a national conversation.
Within our governments, within the leaders in this country, we need them to kind of have that top-down effect, because without that, like the people on the trenches of society, they're not going to hear these kind of things. Where it's on a national agenda, it's going to reach the people that don't know and the people that may not necessarily agree. And with those people, we can actually, I believe, always trying to find a middle ground with these kind of people. But with those people, we actually engage in a conversation that can actually build the community together. And I don't think, like, when it comes to loads, like different topics such as like sexuality, religion and all these things, I don't think it's all about like total acceptance, but it's about that respect and dignity as a human being. And I believe that the vast majority of the population believe that on a baseline, we're all human beings and we're deserving of respect and dignity. And with that should come, let's say, policies that are anti-racist, policies that are, that do reflect the multicultural reality that we do live in Ireland. So I think that's it's really important to have a national sort of conversation around, let's say, issues of racism in Ireland.
Clearly, the conversation needs to happen through mainstream media also. None of the minorities I spoke to felt sufficiently represented by the national broadcaster, which acknowledges more needs to be done. Spíseach Zelinski is Diversity and Inclusion Lead at RTE.
It is a long-term project where progress has been made in certain areas of diversity, but we do recognize that more needs to be done, and we are very committed to doing more and to progressing it further towards better representation, better connection with different communities.
The government has begun a public consultation on anti-racism, which will feed into its overall national anti-racism plan. But arguably, a broader conversation is required to facilitate it prior to its publication at the end of the year.
And that report was from Alva Keneally, our social affairs correspondent. In her final report tomorrow, Alva will be reporting on tackling racism through education.
Now, the cost of a stamp is set to rise from the end of this month. The price of a national stamp is in line for an increase of 10 cent to 1 euro and 10 cent. International stamps will rise from 1.70 to 2 euro. We can talk now to the chief executive of AnPost, David McRedmond. David McRedmond, you're welcome to the programme. So 1 euro and 10 cent now to post a letter. When will it arrive?
So this will come in a month's time. We're giving a month's notice on this. You know, this was a price increase, Audrey, that we announced actually in February over a year ago, in February 2020. And we postponed it because of the pandemic as a measure of social solidarity. So it's actually about 15 months since we announced it before we implement it. You know, for us, it's very important. It's about investing in the network for the future. The last time we increased the stamp price was over 4 years ago. And in that period, we invested very heavily in automation and electric vehicles and new products and services. And I think the benefit of that was seen actually over the past year during the pandemic, when we, you know, managed to keep our networks fully open, you know, despite all the pressures of COVID. On any given day, 99% of routes were serviced and 99% of post offices were open. And you know, COVID cost us 50 million euros because of you know, replacement staff and PPE costs, etc. But we funded all of that from our own balance sheet. We had no recourse to government funding. So this is all about AnPost managing our core economics responsibly, so we've got a sustainable company, long-term company, so we can deliver a great public service.
Okay, so if I pay 1 euro and 10 cent to post my birthday card from Dublin to Cork, will it arrive in Cork the next day?
Yes.
Guaranteed?
Yes.
Okay, because earlier in the year you were saying that you were looking at a system where the 1 euro 10 cent service would take up to 2 days to deliver, and if people wanted an important letter sent guaranteed next day, they would have to pay more. That's not happening, is it?
So, you know, we're experimenting, we're testing that as an option, but we haven't made any decision about that. We won't make a decision until the end of the year. You know, the priorities for customers have changed dramatically over the past couple of years. So when letters used to be the most important thing, actually parcels are way more important for customers now, and having the parcel delivered in the right place at the right time is seen as really urgent. Some letters aren't so urgent, some are way more urgent. So we're going to keep experimenting and testing what the options are. But for now, what we're doing is simply implementing a price increase from last year. And this is the service that people know today.
Okay. Will there be an increase in sending a parcel through the post?
No, we're not increasing parcel prices. And also, we're making absolutely sure, you know, it's so important for SMEs. We know that this period, as Ireland goes into recovery from the pandemic, we know for some SMEs it's an incredibly tough time. So we're actually extending the discounts that we put in place during the pandemic for SMEs. So, for example, they'll get a 34% discount on parcels, and we're extending that right through to the end of 2021, and indeed a 5% discount in mail. So we really want to make sure that what we are doing is investing in an infrastructure that I think we've learned during the pandemic is a vital national infrastructure. That's what we want to do. But we also want to make sure that we can support SMEs through this period.
Thank you very much indeed. The Chief Executive of AmPus, David McRedmond.
Driving tests for non-essential workers are set to resume from next Monday. However, there are now more than 100,000 people waiting for a test with waiting times of up to 6 months. Figures released to the Labour TD Sean Sherlock show Cork, Dublin and Kildare have the worst waiting times. There are also long delays for the driver theory test. Owen Kenny is a 21-year-old teaching student from Mallow in County Cork. His driver theory test has now been cancelled 5 times. He'll need a car to get to his teaching practice, and he says he needs to be able to make plans.
It is very difficult at the moment to try and make plans for whether or not I will be going to placement or whether or not the school I will be going to, that I will have transport there. Over a year ago now since I booked the theory test, and I'm still unaware as to when I'm actually going to have the theory test, be able to go into a test centre and complete it, or perhaps even if the situation was that we'd be able to do it online, at least we would have it out the way and we could apply for the learner's permit, get into a car and start actually doing our 12 lessons before actually completing a driver test.
And Labour's Sean Sherlock joins us now on the line. I suppose it was inevitable in one way that there would be a backlog. It is an enormous one, though. How should it be tackled, do you think?
Good morning, Rachel. I think the first thing the Minister needs to do is to deliver on the 20 pop-up driver testing centres that he has stated that he will create. And we have a parliamentary question in today for answer today, asking where those would be located, because that will help to get down the numbers. The other thing is that, as Owen says there in your clip, they need to move the driver theory testing system online now, because, you know, there are so many people in that category who want to get moving, who need to start their lessons because their livelihoods will depend on it. And you could do that in a in a very short space of time, because the capacity is there within the system to do it for, you know, heavy goods vehicles, and it could be translated across to cars, and that could be done very quickly as well. I think the minister needs to consider bringing driving instructors who are in the system now across into the driver testing system. They have the skills, they have the capacity, they have the professional competency to be able to do that, and that would also have a major bearing on maybe getting down the numbers. But we certainly want to see the details of what the minister is proposing in relation to the 20 pop-up centres, because, you know, as we know, you know, as people, you know, as the economy opens up, as people, you know, begin to move again, you know, there are cohorts of people who rely on, you know, the car. It's still a core component of living and working in Ireland, no matter where you live. And we had a situation yesterday where a gentleman contacted me from Fermoy, who was told that if he wanted to get his driver theory test, he would have to go to Carrick-on-Shannon, County Leitrim, to get it done. So that's absolutely ridiculous.
He'd have to
ridiculous.
Go from Fermoy to Carrick-on-Shannon to do a theory test.
Absolutely. So that's why I don't want to be disrespectful to the minister, but when you have a minister who's in charge of energy, communications, transport, you know, it's too much, I think, for one minister to manage all of this. There needs to be a dedicated minister for transport, and there needs to be, I mean, if Minister Heather Humphreys is listening to this, or the Taoiseach is listening to this, you know, people are still going to be stuck on the pup payments because they won't be able to take up job opportunities. And that gentleman that I've just referred to there, you know, needs to get his driver theory test. He needs to get his 12 lessons because he needs to be able to take up employment. Mm-hmm. Right now, he's going to be stuck on a Department of Social Protection payment because he's been denied the opportunity, you know, to get moving.
Right.
You know, and this is the net effect of all of this.
All right.
So the minister needs to create some urgency around this.
Yeah, listen, we're going to have to leave it at that, but I have a feeling we'll be hearing more about this. Sean Sherlock, thank you very much for joining us.